On Sunday, September 4th at 11 p.m., Sugar and My Bowl will present composer, musician, and half of the innovative production team, the Mizell Brothers, Larry Mizell. That's Sunday, September 4th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. And as I mentioned, and as the promo stated, this is Sugar in My Bowl, and my name's Joyce Jones, and tonight's guest is Larry Mizell. And let's see, I think we should just get to that right now. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I am speaking with...
Larry Mizell.
Larry Mizell. First off, I'm glad you said your name, because over the years I've heard it pronounced differently, and I've was never certain myself. So how often do you get that?
You know, quite a bit, especially if we're outside of the country, we get different pronunciations. And
you know, I'm hesitant about even starting this way, but I do have to acknowledge the passing of your brother, Alfonso.
Yeah.
And I extend my condolences to your family.
He's here in spirit, and I think you contacted us for both of us when he was with us.
Exactly.
We talked about this.
I had reached out to Larry Jr., as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right.
And I was actually going to the air on the 10th when I heard from Jeff Chang. He had mentioned it. At the time, when I heard from Jeff Chang, I was looking and all I saw was a blog.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of bloggers were up on it.
You know, I had heard that one of our friends from Red Bull, the Atlanta division, had called and was talking about how the internet was blowing up.
Twitter.
And I contacted some of the people. We've done over the past decade a lot of work with the Red Bull Music Academy because of their focus on youngsters and their talented youngsters and their involvement in music in various areas.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to do a bit of traveling with them, but it was always gratifying engaging with the people who would attend.
Let's go back in time then. So you were born in Inglewood, New Jersey, huh?
No, actually, we ended up there, but Alphonse and I were born at Medical Center in up around 180th Street, 170th Street, up by the New York City, Manhattan.
Oh, that's, was it Washington Heights?
Yeah, Washington Heights.
Okay.
We grew up in the Lincoln Projects, which were brand new at the time, at 135th and Madison.
Wow.
And then we also grew up at the what's, you know, called Sugar Hill at the top of where the old Polo Grounds used to be,
mm-hmm.
up at right across from Yankee Stadium at 155th and Edgecombe.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend who's over there now, actually.
Oh, okay. 555.
And that's exactly where she is.
That's the building. That's the coolest building on the strip.
It is. Like, all the cool folks are in 555.
Yeah. And back in the day when we lived there, a lot of celebrities, people like Dr. Logan, who was a family doctor, but he was Duke Ellington's doctor.
Oh.
There's a street name for him in Harlem now. I believe Coleman Hawkins lived there.
Wow.
Yeah, we're New Yorkers by birth.
Okay. Excellent. And
yeah.
So am I. I love New York. I'm a Harlemite.
Oh, yeah. We have a strong fondness. In fact, I went to grad school at NYU. You know, every time we go back, even if we're going to Europe or something like crossing the Atlantic, we always try and manage to break the trip up by spending 3 or 4 days in New York. And then we actually went to high school in New Jersey.
Okay.
We moved there when we were in our early teens,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the Inglewood connection came in, which is like you can be in the city like in less than 15 minutes.
I see. Tell me about you and Fonz growing up musically. What were you exposed to?
Our parents were big music fans. We had lots of records in the house. The swing bands of the day, Ellington, of course, Basie, and even Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, we were exposed to that. We had an uncle by the name of Andy Razoff, and he was listed in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, but he was listed as one of the most prolific, they say, songwriters of the 1940s.
Wow.
And he had written a lot of songs, 500 or 600 songs.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's a book out on him called Black and Blue that Bobby Short wrote the intro to. He was a lyricist. He wrote Ain't Misbehavin' with Pat Wallace.
Oh.
All of those songs and a lot of other hits. But he also wrote a song for that was one of Glenn Miller's big songs called In the Mood.
Really? Oh, yeah, my goodness.
We were influenced by my grandmother talking about Uncle Andy. When I say influenced, probably subliminally. It kind of stuck with us. She was mentioning that he was always getting royalties, residuals from all of his songwriting over the years. And that was in our mind. But on the actual musical instrument side, we started off with, at the time, singing groups were popular.
Mm-hmm.
Doo-wop singing groups under the streetlights.
Right.
Type of scenario. And we had a couple of groups in junior high school and high school. And then we picked up trumpet. We both got trumpets and joined the high school band.
How did you wind up choosing the trumpet, both of you?
You know, that's really a good question. I'm not sure how that came about. I think we just thought it was a cool instrument. And I remember that there was a guy from the musical store in Inglewood who came up to the high school and demonstrated a bunch of instruments. Oh, he had a whole bunch of them sitting out, and he offered a leasing plan where they could rent the instruments to see if they were really interested and take lessons. And we chose trumpet. We subsequently joined the high school band.
How was it playing in a marching band? Was it a marching band?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
It was a marching band, and it was great. You know, I was so glad to see Drumline come out, which was one of the first movies to really capture that's a whole lifestyle, being in a marching band for the football games. And we enjoyed it. The marching, that aspect of it, the exposure to different types, styles of music that we probably wouldn't have broached without that. But, yeah, it was great.
So how did you decide to pursue music more intently? Because I understand Fonce was first.
Fonce was first. We started off after high school. Fonce and I and another partner, Freddie Perrin, who lived around the corner, we all three went to Howard University in D.C.
Right.
as freshmen. And we started a singing group there. Along with our studies, we got into that. And we were fortunate enough, we got into the Homecoming Talent Show as freshmen, and we won the trophy. And so we stuck with the singing group, and we did kind of we were doing jazz-style harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
Not typical of the songs that were on the radio at the time, when Motown was just emerging.
Mm, right.
And we were big fans of that. But we were singing in a different kind of a style, and it kind of gave us a unique niche where we had some success with the singing group in college.
That group was called the Vanlords?
Yes. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, the Vanlords.
Yeah.
And from there, we, like I said, were really digging what Berry Gordy was doing with Motown, and we formed our own record company as students called Hog. H-O-G Records.
Right.
And we found a group at a neighboring college in Baltimore, Morgan State, and came up with the name The Moments.
Oh, okay.
Wrote several songs for them. We got some sorority sisters, some AKAs to sing background.
Now, apparently there's this one song, Baby, I Want You.
Yes.
Is that a recording?
Yes. That was the A-side of the first single, of the only single we did on them.
Oh,
and it's a song I wrote. And what happened was we mixed and had the record pressed up, and we had an apartment full of these records. We were not too sophisticated in distribution, which was the next major step. But we got the experience of putting together the record. We really didn't sell any records, really.
Oh, my.
We had boxes of records, and we would crack jokes about all these records. And eventually, we all graduated and moved out and went out different ways. But apparently one of the records surfaced somewhere on eBay about 7-8 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you have one yourself? Do you have a copy?
Well, I did, but I couldn't find it.
Oh, okay.
And I really looked for it because it ended up on eBay, and it was a 45, and it ended up selling for $5,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And by then, I really started looking for my own record.
Satisfied.
But there's a few of them out there, maybe three or four I've seen, and they'll go for a pretty hefty price.
So it hasn't been transferred to anything digital yet?
Actually, it has.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it has. Are you familiar with Wax Poetics?
Yes. The magazine.
The magazine.
And the record label.
Right. The record label used to be run by Amir. He has put out several records himself, but he came on board at Wax with Andre, and they were starting a record label, and they got with us, and we found one of the 45s that one of my other partners, and we transferred it digitally and cleaned up the wear and tear. So it was re-released about 4 years ago.
Oh.
We flew back into New York for a record release party down at their headquarters in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow. So for the 145?
For the 145.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It was a release party for a 45
for
record.
For a 45. And Wax is really cool like that.
Yeah.
They did a nice graphic job on it.
Uh-huh.
They printed it on thick vinyl.
Oh, okay.
So it was a quality record. And it was re-released after all these years.
Wow. So I should be able to find it digitally somewhere then, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you can find it on iTunes and okay. and other places. And from Wax Poetics, the records. Myself, Fonz, and my other brother, Rod, and my wife, Yvonne, we came into New York. Coincidentally, Bobby showed up, Bobby Humphrey.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
She showed up. I hadn't seen her in years. That was great. And she showed up with her daughter, Ricky Lynn, who was the baby on the cover of the Satin Doll album.
Exactly.
So what we did was we had a picture with Bobby and Ricky, and someone found a copy of the album, and we took a picture of that.
Bobby Humphrey had mentioned that when she was a guest on Sugar My Bowl, that Wax Poetics had put on this event. I didn't know it was for a 45 single.
Yeah, that was quite a unique release party.
Now, tell me about your brother. You mentioned Ron?
Rod. Rodney is his full name.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So where does Rod come in?
Rod is about 14 years apart from... Fonz and I are a year apart.
Right.
Fonz is a year older than I am.
Rod, he was born on January 15th, 1943,
right.
And you were born on February 17th, 1944.
Right, okay. Right. The next year, sometimes we would say we were 7 months apart.
Oh.
Yeah, Rodney was 14 years behind us.
Uh-huh.
So we really didn't engage on a musical level until he got into his teens. And he's a very adept and accomplished bass and drummer.
Did he work with you and Fonz during recordings?
Yes. He did. He moved to Los Angeles in the mid-70s and wrote and played on sessions. I believe he played on the Bobby Humphrey session.
Okay.
He played on all the bass on the Rance Allen album, played bass on the Mary Wells record that we did.
What's he doing now?
Well, we all still live just outside of L.A.
Okay.
And we have a few studios, and we're working on new material.
Now, I know I'm pretty much fast-forwarding, but I was of the understanding that you and Fonz had retired. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, and you know, in the music business, it's kind of a nebulous term, because you can always, you know, like, what have you done for me lately?
Oh, I see.
But we had worked for well over 12 years steadily without a break, because we loved what we were doing. So by the mid-80s, we just decided to take a break. It was not too long after the Mary Wells record. And I mentioned about Andy Rizoff and his songs and the royalties. We had put together a decent publishing catalog, and we retained all of our publishing. So we just retired and just started traveling and playing tennis and basketball.
Oh, wow.
For years. And that was definitely what you'd call a retired phase.
Now, the Mary Wells recording that you're referring to is a Gigolo?
Gigolo. TV1 is airing documentary on Mary Wells.
Unsung.
Unsung. That was the last video of Fonz and I together.
Oh, okay.
We did that a few months ago, I think in April.
You eventually go to Howard University.
Right.
And I guess you and Fonz are there together?
Yes, Fonz and Freddie. We were roommates off camp.
When did you meet Donald Byrd?
Donald came on the scene after I graduated, and Fonz and Freddie were majoring in music in various disciplines, music education, composition, while I was majoring in electrical engineering. But I spent almost half of my time at the music building playing piano. They have, you know, rows and rows of piano rooms. that only music students were supposed to use, but I would have to sneak past the guard, and I'd have my slide rule, which was what we used in those days.
Right.
To get past the guard, and he'd see the slide rule and bust me. But when I could, I spent a lot of time at the music building. And plus, we were our singing group. We were rehearsing over there all the time. Also, we had various piano players for our singing group during the Howard years, but one was Donny Hathaway.
Yes. How was that experience?
Oh, he was just fantastic. When he came in as a freshman, he was, I think his father was a minister, mm-hmm. and he said he couldn't play secular music.
Oh.
He wasn't going to do that. But we heard him playing in one of those practice rooms I was talking about,
mm-hmm.
and we noticed how talented he was. But eventually, he liked what we were doing, and we liked what he was doing, and we got together. He was so talented. Mm-hmm. When we would win in the vocal group category, he would win in the solo piano category.
That's really interesting because most people are familiar with his singing voice.
Right.
He singing? He wasn't singing then? Or?
Not at all.
Huh.
We had no idea that he could sing until he went to Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And got with Curtis Mayfield. And what a singer. What a voice.
Yeah.
What a signature of tremendous voice. Even his daughter Layla has.
Yes. So you're an engineer sneaking into the piano room. And eventually you wind up working with Grumman Aerospace.
Yes. I was right out of Howard. I went to Grumman Aerospace in Long Island. And we
never actually talked about how they ran into Donald Byrd.
Right. Well, Freddie graduated, I graduated, and Fonz still had another year to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that year, Donald came on board as, I guess you call him an adjunct professor. He was there teaching a music course, a music history course based on his experiences in the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very popular with the students, and a lot of people signed up for his class. But that's when Fonz took one of those classes from Byrd.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he ran into Byrd for the first time.
Oh, okay. So how did they wind up at Motown?
Well, there's a Howard connection there as well. Fonz and Freddie hooked up with one of the, I believe it was an instructor at the music department at Howard. And he had a cousin who was starting up a record company in Los Angeles and was looking for writers to come join the startup company in L.A. And so Fonz talked with Freddie about it, and when Fonz graduated, he moved to L.A., and that would probably be 67, 68, and Freddie joined him there. This startup record company eventually floundered fairly quickly.
Now, that was Larco?
That was Larco.
Yeah, Los Angeles Recording Company.
Right. So they were in touch with one of the ladies from Howard who had a friend who was working at Motown at the time. He may have been a manager or an assistant at Motown, but I think he was working with Diana Ross.
Okay.
But he knew Deke Richards, and that's what Fonz and Freddie wanted to get into, again, was writing and producing. Through this guy, Dick Scott, they set up an audition with Deke Richards, who was a Motown producer at the time out of Detroit.
Now, what did the audition entail?
Well, I'm a little hazy on the actual details, but I do know that they wrote a lot of songs over a few days.
Oh.
Like 10 or 15 songs.
Oh, my goodness.
It could have been a little longer than that, maybe a couple of weeks. And they went into the audition and just played the songs, and Deke liked them and encouraged Berry Gordy to sign them. So they got signed as writers and producers and suggested that they form a nucleus and named it the Corporation. That consisted of Fonz, Freddie, Deke, and Berry Gordy.
Oh, okay. I always wondered about that when I would look at the Jackson 5 recordings and see the Corporation. I was like, what is this weirdness?
Right.
So how did anyone really receive credit after that? How did that determine itself legally? Because they had the writer of the song as the Corporation.
Right. Well, that was just the printed label, but the paperwork behind it had everything broken down.
Okay.
But it may have been an effort, there's been speculation about this, but it may have been an effort to keep that mystique that you mentioned.
Oh, I see.
Because Holland, Doja Holland had just recently left.
Oh, okay.
They were the big hit makers. Their name had gotten out there individually, and it may have been a move to keep it close to the vest, because the name Fonz and Freddie's name didn't come out for a while, and still on a limited basis. On the sheet music, you could see it.
Okay.
Yeah, if you ventured to get the sheet music.
Right, exactly.
But, yeah, they did get paid equitably.
Okay, good. Whew.
Bottom line.
Yes. So tell me about the song that they originally wrote for Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Yeah. It turned out as the corporation was formed that their first project was to cut a track on Gladys Knight, and which they were really good about, well, the major artists like that. So they had written a song to be cut very next day, as the story goes. Barry called the night before the session and said that, look, I have some kids I just signed, and I want you to change the name, change the concept of the song to fit these kids, and we're going to cut that song, and we're going to not do the original Gladys session. They changed the title to I Want You Back. Cut the Track was similar. I have the original sheet music that shows Gladys Knight on it.
Wow.
It was the same song, same bass line and everything. And the kids were such a talent, and with Motown's marketing muscle behind them, a good song.
Mm-hmm.
It took off. And Motown took a posture of not putting the kids on tour until after, I think, the third record.
Hmm.
So they didn't start off playing small venues. The first three records all went number one platinum.
Oh, by the way, we should say that the kids are the Jackson 5.
Yeah. Those are the kids.
Yes.
The kids that they were down about, oh, we have to record some kids. So they had three monstrous records behind them before they ever hit the stage.
Right.
They did some TV shows, and so they started touring at big venues, Madison Square Garden, places like that.
Unfortunately, they came to Greenville, South Carolina, in what was our big venue. I was living with my siblings in Greenville at the time. We were living with our grandmother.
Okay.
And they did pretty much the same show that they did on Going Back to Indiana, the TV special.
Right.
With
right.
Diana Ross. And,
oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that must have been great.
Oh, it was. We were in the nosebleed seats, but it was just fabulous. It sounded wonderful. We screamed as loud as everyone else.
And they were great to this day. The early J5 stuff still sells because, you know, little kids can relate to little kids as role models. And at that time, the only other phenomenon that we'd had like that predates going back to the 50s was Frankie Lyman and the teenagers.
Right.
And all the kids were into that. And, of course, Frankie grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But he could sing. He could really sing
right.
as a kid. He wasn't just a little kid.
Well, there were the 5 stair steps in between.
Don't want to slight them.
Yes. It's like talking about the Jackson 5 and not mentioning the Silvers. Yeah,
yeah right. The Osmonds came on the scene.
Right. Well, in a different way.
In a different way.
Because they were doing Barbershop before.
Mm-hmm. And they came in, I think, with One Bad Apple.
So at what point did Font stop working with the J5, Jackson 5?
Time-wise, it would probably be... See, when I came out, Font and I got together. I moved to Hollywood in 71, right after I finished NYU. And I had been keeping my music chops alive, but I had 2 bands and a singing group on the weekends, and I had a songwriter partner. And Font and I were always in contact, of course, and I was visiting him. I was doing my engineering thing and had been traveling, delivering technical papers, and at the same time wearing my musical hats on the weekends. But anyway, we decided to hook up with the idea of starting an independent production company at some point. But I moved in. We got a house together, and we started writing together. I was playing on Motown sessions, playing keyboards.
Mm.
And the very first break from the corporation, as I remember, was because I played synthesizer on the Edwin Starr album for the Fred Williamson movie, Hell Up in Harlem.
Oh.
Soundtrack to that. Freddie and Fonz did that.
Okay.
So that was a break right there because it was by Freddie and Fonz, handwritten. From there, I brought some songs from New York with me,
mm-hmm.
and Marvin Gaye's best album of all time.
What's Going On? Mm-hmm.
Had just killed everybody. It was Motown was looking for the follow-up, and it turned out that it was a slow fruition for the follow-up to that album as far as Marvin's creativity or just coming up with something to top that. So it was opened up to the other producers to come in with songs for this follow-up to What's Going On. So anyway, I had some songs with me, and Foss and I worked on them. We had a four-track studio at our house in Hollywood. And so we took those songs in to the screening crew for the songs. And so all three of ours got accepted. Marvin put vocals on two of them. We cut two songs on Marvin. And in a beautiful twist of fate, Fonz Freddy and I sang background behind Marvin on the song.
Now, which songs were these?
Actually, they never got released at that time. Marvin went on to do the soundtrack to Trouble Man. So those were put in the can.
But one was salvaged during a remaster.
Exactly. That was called Where Are We Going?
Day by day, the work gets done. Day by day.
And I always make the mistake of thinking, you know, it's called day in, day out.
Right. Oh, that's a good observation, Joyce, because, you know, that's what you think of.
Right.
We were singing the song. That's the first thing that comes in.
All right.
But, yeah, that was a single, which was released in early 2000 after Motown had been sold. And it was on three different compilations, and all of them went gold. So we got gold records.
Hey.
20 years later, 30 years later.
Wasn't it also recorded by Donald Byrd?
Exactly.
On which one?
The first album, on Blackbird.
Blackbird.
Right. And the other song that Marvin put vocals on, which was Fonz and myself, favorite song that we had done on him, was called Woman of the World.
Oh, yeah.
And we recorded that on Byrd as well, on the Street Lady album.
Okay.
But Woman of the World has never come out. Few people have heard it. I've played it at different Red Bull Academy sessions.
Right, yes. I remember listening to that when listening to the webcast.
Right, of the probably the Melbourne session.
Right, exactly. Is there a plan to do something with that?
I've been talking with Universal. Mm-hmm. I have a friend over there in charge of reissuing at Universal, and we're talking about remixing it and getting it out there.
Okay. Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. And what you're listening to in the background is Donald Byrd's Women of the World, which was written by Larry Mizell and L. Gorton. Where are my glasses? Yes, I have glasses now. I have readers, so I can read all this teeny tiny print. And, let's see, before this, we were listening to, Where Are We Going? The song which I occasionally refer to as Day In, Day Out. Perhaps I should tell you what's happening on, Women of the World. We don't have a lot of time at this one. Let me hurry up. Donald Byrd on trumpet. Flugelhorn, solo vocals and some things. Roger Glenn on flute, that's who we're listening to now. David T. Walker on guitar, Jerry Peters on piano, Fender Rhodes. Fonz Mizell on clavinet, trumpet. Yeah, actually, as a matter of fact, he played trumpet on something earlier. Let me finish this list. Fred Perrin on ARP synthesizer, Chuck Rainey on electric bass, Harvey Mason on drums, Stephanie Spruill on percussion, and King Erickson on congas. And the vocals are performed and arranged by Fonz Mizell, Fred Perrin, and Larry Mizell, our guest on Sugar in My Bowl this evening. This is on a Blue Note label, 1973 release. I really am talking over this one. But this is their favorite, Woman of the World. Not this version, the Marvin Gaye one. And since that isn't available, we're playing the Donald Byrd one. Before that, as I mentioned, we listened to Where Are We Going? From this is from Let's Get It On. It was a double CD packed with special items. And this is the one where Fonz Mizell, the other half of the Mizell brothers, who recently transitioned on June 10th. This is what he played trumpet on. Where Are We Going? On Marvin Gaye's version. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we have blah, blah, blah. Fonz Mizell on trumpet, as I mentioned, the trumpet solo. Larry Mizell on keyboards. David T. Walker on guitar, Ron Brown on bass, Ed Green on drums, Jack Ashford on percussion, Maestro Rhythm King was the drum machine, Freddie Perren, Fonz Mizell, and Larry Mizell background vocals. And yes, Where Are We Going was written by Larry Mizell and Larry Gordon, the two Larrys. Let's see, before that we heard, you know, anyway, there's a lot going on in here right now. Before that we heard, I skipped over the Donald Byrd version, which is from Blackbird, and that has Donald Byrd on trumpet, flugelhorn, electric trumpet, lead vocals, Fonz Mizell on trumpet vocals, Roger Glenn, flutes, saxophone, Joe Sample on piano, electric piano, Fred Perren on electric piano, synthesizers, vocals, Dean Parks on guitar, Wilton Felder on electric bass, Harvey Mason on drums, Bobby Porter Hall on percussion, and the vocal arrangements, and also vocals, are courtesy of our guest, Larry Mizell, and this is on from Blackbird, 1972, on the Blue Note label. Alrighty. Let's see, what else do we have here? We have Airport Chase, which is from Hell Up in Harlem, the soundtrack. That was written by Larry Mizell. Before that, we have... What do we have? Well, we had all that... Where are we? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Airport Chase. And before that, we have I Want You Back, Jackson 5, from Diana Ross Presents the Jackson 5. Motown, 1968. Oh, we should go back to this. Oh, and before that, we have Baby, I Want You by The Moments. And you have to listen carefully. You can get this, Baby, I Want You by The Moments, via Wax Poetics. We love Wax Poetics. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in my bowl.
But so far it's been in the can. So that time period there, the Edwin Starr, Marvin Gaye, I wrote another song with Mom, our mother.
Oh.
By the way, called Wigs and Lashes.
And what became of that one?
we recorded that on Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons.
What?
Who were signed to Motown at the time.
Oh my gosh.
That's still in the can. It never came out.
Okay.
But it was re-recorded, Fonz re-recorded it on The Miracle.
Oh.
And that did come out. It came out as a single and on the Renaissance album by The Miracle. That one is still around, the 45 as well. So there were independent projects right during that period, which probably would have been 72 through 73 when all of that was happening. So that would have been timeline-wise the period of the split.
Oh, okay. Now, by the time it's, I guess, at some point in 73, you've teamed up with Donald Byrd.
Yes.
How did that team start?
Yeah, well, it was, again, as you mentioned earlier, the connection was from Fonz's hookup with Byrd at school.
Right.
Byrd came by one evening to the crib in Hollywood, and he said, "Look, man, I'm recording some... straight-ahead jazz things tomorrow at A&M Records Studios. Do you have anything? I've been writing some things, and I've been using some sound effects, and Fonz and I had been, we've been writing some things. So we played these things we've done. And Byrd said, you know, that sounds pretty cool. Let's record them tomorrow."
Wow.
So we said, okay, that sounds good. And we were looking to kick our independent production thing off anyway.
Right. Sky High.
Sky High.
Okay.
And So we did. We cut that tune, which turned out to be Flight Time, and then another song called Mr. Thomas. Mm-hmm. And we used a rhythm device called the Maestro Rhythm King, which was a drum box that had canned rhythms in it, cha-cha, rumba, samba rhythms, and you could push buttons and get these different rhythms, and you just control the tempo.
Right.
We'd gotten hit to it because Sly Stone used it on a number of his records.
Oh, okay.
And we cut those two songs. Bird cut the straight-ahead stuff first. We cut those two songs, and that's how that whole project came about.
Hi, this is Spike Lee, and you're listening to WBAI Community Radio in New York City. WBAI exists almost entirely on your support. Please be generous. Thank you very much.
After we cut those two songs at that session, it was still about 6 months before we finally got a call from Blue Note Enberg to go ahead and do the whole album.
Wow. Okay.
And that's how Blackbird was born.
And a very lucrative relationship with Blue Note.
Yes.
Or
Blue.
Extensive.
Yes, all of the above. I mean, we just felt blessed because it was the first album out of the box for our production company. And it was number one on the jazz charts for probably 6 or 7 months. It got a Grammy nomination and became Blue Note's biggest selling record in their whole history.
Wow. Okay.
So we were off to a flying start with Bird. And it just appealed to a broader range of people. It wasn't jazz. It was, we were doing our thing with the songs. We presented to Bird. He dug them.
Mm.
Kind of an instrumental funk thing. And we were singing on it. We had the three of us, Freddie Fonse and I, sang background on those
records. Now, it's interesting that you said it wasn't jazz. Is that because that's what was said, or you knew as you were doing it you weren't really jazz?
We knew as we were doing it that it wasn't jazz. I mean, Bird was soloing over the grooves that we were putting down.
Right.
And we wrote the horn lines out. And, you know, it was kind of at the crossover when you had jazz rock with Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Mm-hmm.
And with some of the records that were coming out of Blue Note that was like solo with single efforts, like Lee Morgan's Sidewinder.
Right.
Things with the funk drumming underneath them.
And there's Lou Donaldson.
Lou Donaldson. Those kind of things were coming out. And we put a different twist on it. We added synthesizers that were coming out at the time. And it was just a great time. Everybody was happy. Bird was happy. We were happy. And Blue Note was happy.
Now, the sound that you really created a sound. What was that like? I mean, you were just having fun and you just went with it. You were experimenting. What was that like?
That pretty much encapsulates it. Joyce, we were having fun and we were experimenting. We had synthesizers that had just come out, and these were the new preset synthesizers where you didn't have to patch a lot of cables and getting into that mode of creation that might take you off of getting stuff finished. You could dial up certain sounds and play with the filters and adjust them, and you immediately had a sound. We combined that with some traditional acoustic sounds. We doubled the synthesizer bass line with the grand piano playing octaves on the left hand.
Mm.
And then we would have the bass player, Chuck Rainey, double that. And so it gave a really thick, pounding bass. And we were singing vocal phrases. We never sang, only on a few songs did we have full lyrics.
Mm.
For the song. But we would sing kind of suggestions of what the song was about. We'd get creative with the harmonies and we'd trick the rhythms up, little different things coming in, and we'd always mix in different musical sections to keep the interest up.
The vocals I thought were rather interesting on a lot of the recordings because there were harmonies, but there oftentimes you sang in unison.
Right, right. That was one of our trademarks from Howard that we used. Many times we would build our vocals around the lead singer or around the lead vocal. It was just something we came up with, and I don't think we originated it, but it was just something we did. And we were having fun. It was like being in school again, three of us singing.
Now, did you have anything to do with the Blackbirds?
Oh, yeah, very much so. We first met the Birds. I know we did the Berklee Jazz Festival, but we also did the Montreux Jazz Festival. And we made up T-shirts for the group. Well, what happened was Bert had put together a group of guys, some of his partners, to play some of the songs on the album.
Mm-hmm.
And that really wasn't working out. The sound was not happening. Too much into a straight-ahead feel.
Okay.
So Bert went with some of the students, all students from Howard, and he brought them in, and they had enthusiasm to make up for their lack of experience.
Uh-huh.
We had T-shirts made up for them, and all of them had the name of the album on the back that said Blackbird.
Oh.
So on stage, you just saw a bunch of Blackbird shirts. So what was the next step is, what should we call them? And so that's how the Blackbirds came about.
Oh.
¶¶
Okay, I'm back. Let's see, let me get this out of the way right now. What we're listening to is the Blackbirds. Joe Hall on bass. Keith Kilgo on drums. Kevin Tony on keyboards, melodies, synthesizers. Barney Perry on guitar. Alan Barnes on soprano or tenor sax. And Perk Jacobs on percussion. And this lovely recording was written by, it is called Reggins, R-E-G-G-I-N-S, and it was composed by our guest Larry Mizell. And Larry Mizell, one half of the Mizell brothers, Alfonso Ponce Mizell, having transitioned in June, is still with us in spirit, and musically he will always be with us. So stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl. Before that we heard Flight Time. Listeners to WBAI will recognize that song as being the theme of the GBE, Imhotep Gary Bird's program on Saturday, 5 p.m., 5 to 7, and on other stations. Stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl. And WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
So we did the very first album, the one with the Van Gogh painting on the cover.
Okay, okay.
The Crows in the Field.
Uh-huh.
We did that up in Berkeley at Fantasy Records.
Okay.
That was big fun. It was great working with the Birds. They were hadn't graduated that long after us. And so we had a lot of fun together. We traveled. We went to the Montreux Jazz Festival with the entire Blue Note artist roster.
Wow.
And staff on one plane. We all met up in Boston to catch the Blue Note plane in Switzerland.
Oh, my goodness.
So the plane was crazy, the plane ride.
What do you mean, Larry?
I mean, I saw, you know, Bird went over. Kevin Tony was asleep with his mouth open. And Bird went over and poured salt in his body.
Oh, gosh.
And everybody just fell out laughing. Woody Shaw was coming down the aisle just cussing out everybody.
Oh, no.
And the stewardesses were like, well, everybody get in their seats, you know. It was, and that's just a mild version of what went on. But, you know, what an experience with all of these greats.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Fonk and I, we, to even meet more greats in Switzerland, and we traveled Europe a bit after that. We went to Bird's apartment in Paris and stayed there. He gave us the keys.
Okay.
Afterwards, and the album Blackbird was big. We were hearing it all over Europe.
Nice.
So, you know, it was a great blessing. But, great times.
You eventually wound up working with Bobby Humphreys.
Yes.
How did you wind up working with Bobby Humphreys?
Well, at this time, Blue Note was located in New York City. They hadn't moved to L.A. yet.
Okay.
They've since moved back to New York. But, and we went to take care of some business meet with George Butler.
And, George Butler was?
The president of Blue Note at the time. And on the song Flight Time, I'd used a sound effects record with a jet plane taking off. And I had to get clearance for that, and it was from Elektra Records, who put out a whole series of sound effects for movies.
Oh, my goodness.
On vinyl. And they would charge you by what they would call per needle drop, how many times you're using it, and they would charge you a certain fee, and what style of record, is it going to be a big record, and they'd adjust their fee accordingly.
Wow.
So we had to go by there, give them a check to get the release.
Mm-hmm.
They were in New York as well. And so we went over to see George at Blue Note. And Bobby was, I think she was sitting on Carol Campbell's desk, who was secretary to George. Bobby was hanging out in the office, and, you know, she looked like a little girl.
Uh-huh.
So we started talking and learned that she was a flute player and she was signed to the label.
Yes, the first woman.
The first woman. You know, it was an interesting prospect, and it ended up being our second Blue Note project.
And that would be Blacks and Blues.
That would be Blacks and Blues. All through that, then we did Fancy Dancer after that, and Satin Doll, which we really had fun doing.
Yeah, those are really nice recordings. What was the breakdown? How did you and Fonz decide who's going to do what? Who was going to produce? Who was going to play? How did you decide who was going to do what?
You know, we kind of had a symbiotic rhythm. We basically did it the same way we would create. We would work at the house, turn on a tape recorder. We basically jam, have all the keyboards turned on, the drums and basses sitting up, and we would make music all night. And then we go through it and find little things that we want. We write them down and put them together and figure out what we wanted to add and then come up with lyrics, titles from there, then schedule a rhythm session, go in and cut the rhythm session. And we would really produce from inside the recording area with the musicians. We were always out there. Fonz would be working with the drummer. I'd be talking with the two guitar players we used, the other keyboard player. And Fonz and I would always have extra keyboards set up, a D6 Hohner clavinet, a Fender Rhodes, along with the acoustic grand.
Oh, okay.
Then we'd have a percussion player in the back, two percussion players, really. Stephanie Spruill and an extra percussion player. We had this particular team, what we call the A-Team, because they were able to fly with the concept. We had the sections broken down of the different parts of the music, and we would just rehearse the different sections of the music over and over until everybody kind of got a nice creative interplay. Then we would tell the engineer, let's, you know, turn the red light on, let's go. So we got a good take. So we were constantly back and forth between the control room and the recording room, playing, making suggestions, and doing different things. And, you know, a lot of times the musicians would chime in where the drummer, Harvey Mason, would hear Jerry Peters on piano play this fast arpeggio solo run going into another section. And he'd say, holler over to Jerry, Jerry, do that again. And then Harvey would play a tom-tom filter exactly on those notes. And so there was all kinds of, we gave them a lot of free rein. It was different from when we would be producing a pop or an R&B record. We would have a different approach. We would be constraining the musicians to the format for a pop or an R&B record. But we gave a lot of creative freedom on the Sky High, Bird, Bobby, jazz fusion things.
Well, I guess that speaks to the language of, quote, jazz.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right. The improvisational nature and spontaneity. And that was showing as well. And they loved it because they rarely got a chance to stretch out like that.
Thank you.
introduce the audience, if they're not familiar, to Johnny Hammond.
Johnny Hammond was signed to Cree Taylor's label, CTI Records, when we first found out about him. He was an excellent Hammond organ player. His real name was John Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And he played a Hammond organ, the B3, and he made some great records with Creed Taylor on the CTI label. And we used to listen to those records. And Creed called probably one of our business contacts to see if we'd be interested in checking Johnny out for a possible recording on one of the CTI labels. So we flew into Detroit to see him. We already liked him because we were already familiar with his record that were coming out at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on that label when they were putting out the Grover Washington record, Inner City Blues, Freddie Hubbard's First Light, all of that.
Yes.
We were just digging that. So we, and they had the Great Arrangers there too, the Sebesky, and the session guys. They had regular session guys too. So we flew into Detroit, checked Johnny out, and then we flew into New York a few weeks later to talk with Creed. And agreed to work with Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he was looking to move away from organ. And he'd gotten into the electric piano, the
right.
Fender Rhodes. And he had a full 88-key Fender Rhodes that he had especially adjusted the feel of the keyboard so it was a light organ touch.
Hmm.
He had incredibly fast technique, super fast hands. So we got started with him at Creed Taylor's label. And first record with him was Gambler's Life.
Yes.
And we had a good time doing that record. Johnny used his band playing. Johnny liked to write really long compositions with different movements in them, where the music would stretch for 3 or 4 feet of sheet music. And they were real compositions. And they were fairly long for a record, a cut. So we had a mixture of his things. We added our sound to some of them on that album. And we cut some of our things on there as well. Gambler's Life, Rhodesian Thoroughfare. Oh, a tune that we cut on Michael Jackson that we cut on Gambler's Life.
Oh, yes. Call on Me?
Yes.
Okay.
That's on the last song, I believe, on Gambler's Life.
Excellent.
And that, yeah, that was a single from...
Farewell, My Summer Love.
Farewell, My Summer Love.
Yes. You know, it was hard to find for a long time, Farewell, My Summer Love. But
yeah, and Johnny was getting down at the end of that, towards the fade of that song. He was really throwing down and on synthesizer.
The next one that you did with him, Gears, that had Los Conquistadores Chocolate.
Yes.
How did that recording come about? Because the introduction is just so dramatic.
We really loved the way it came out. It was... A partner of ours was majoring in Spanish, and he got his master's degree in Spanish from the University of Spain in Madrid. And he was telling us about the story of the Moors and their conquest into southern Spain. And the concept of the song came from that. So we had him write an introduction of a story of an old man telling a little boy about this story.
Okay.
In Spanish. And so it started off with... Conquistadores that we...
Conquistadores.
There it is. We started off with a military drumbeat at the end of my partner's introduction, whose name is Bill Jordan, by the way. As he finished his narration, at the same time, Harvey Mason was playing a military-type drumbeat that was tricked up.
Mm.
There was no particular time, but he was playing rolls and military beats and a kick drum that was kind of twisted up in a funky-type fashion.
Mm.
And then at the same time, I was using an ARP synthesizer for the pink noise generator, sweeping it a filter to give the impression of a wind blowing.
Uh-huh.
And then we put that into an echo chamber and trying to create this howling wind effect. We had a flute player come in and do a kind of a fife and drum thing. And then we built up from there with Jerry coming in with the piano repetition, building up into the groove. We kind of set that up with the guys, and after a few takes, we pulled off something that felt good. And then in the end, we had a cycle of this set of chords that I put together that were coming in the end. It was just a cycle of chords that Harvey was hitting the kick drum as we went through the whole cycle and faded the record out.
Wow!
And it was really different. It was odd.
Mm-hmm.
To some people, and,
it was wonderful.
Yeah,
it's just wonderful.
Yeah. We loved it, and then, years later to see it pick up is because we had a constant pulsing quarter note kick drum throughout the whole song, the main body of the song. So it later became Chicago house type dance thing.
Yes, yes.
Because of that, and who knew that would turn out? But we had a pulse going on, and we loved it from day one.
Yeah, it's an excellent song. To get back to Donald Byrd, since you're still doing work with him. Places and Spaces.
Places and Spaces. That was a fun album.
Change is probably, if anybody's like, just in a blah way, and they put on Change, it's just...
Let's go.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a fun album. I'll tell you how we came up with the title. We were looking for a concept, Fonts and I and Byrd, for the next album. And we were playing tennis with Byrd a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Fonts and I always played tennis all the time.
Oh, okay.
And Byrd, well, we'd come to town. And then, in fact, when he moved to L.A., we would play tennis at night. We even played in Europe a lot of times.
Wow.
So Byrd said, hey, man, you know what? We need to come up with a concept, and why don't we go to Vegas and play some tennis? And the Byrd had just gotten his pilot's license.
Oh, my goodness.
So we rented these planes. We rented two planes, and we all piled into these two private planes and left out of Santa Monica Airport. And if you notice, on the cover of Places and Spaces, there's all these pictures of these private planes flying. Well, that's us in those planes.
Oh, my goodness.
shooting pictures of back and forth.
Oh, wow. actually, that whole period with Blackbird, Caricatures, Places and Spaces, Stepping Into Tomorrow, Street Lady, I think that's it. Yes?
That's it. That's
okay.
It.
That's just, oh my gosh, amazing. Those songs are timeless.
And Street Lady was, Quiet as a Skep, was an homage to women.
Mm.
All the songs have a female bass.
Okay.
It was.
Yeah, it wasn't just a Street Lady.
No, well, Street Lady wasn't our first choice. We wanted to call the album that the Marvin Gaye tune that never came out,
Woman
which
of
is on that album. We wanted to call it Woman of the World.
Right.
It ended up being Street Lady, but there's a song that we really like called Lanzana's Priestess.
Yes, and that's the one that has been a sampler's delight.
It has, and we really dug that song. It just went on and on. Jerry Peters takes a tremendous solo in the last 2-3 minutes of the song, and we were singing on there, and it was an African folk tale about a tribesman, Lanzana, who was in a tribe where the head religious figure was a woman, and he was engaged in talking with the priestess. It was just an imaginary musical trip.
Also on the Blue Note label, you produced and wrote for Gary Bartz and did vocals and, I guess, instrumentation as well for Music Is My Sanctuary.
Oh, okay, right. Well, Gary was, that came about a different way. Gary was actually signed to Fantasy Records.
The label that Blackbird was on.
Right.
Blackbirds.
Right, up in Berkeley. And we ran into Gary at the Montreux Jazz Festival. We really dug what he was doing, and we had just signed a production deal with Fantasy Records, and they asked us to mix Gary's latest album. It was just coming out, called Cinderella, which was still a great album, and remixed that. And then we did an album on Fantasy with Gary called The Shadow Dude.
Yes, yes.
That was the first actual full album that we did with Gary. And then he was released from Fantasy, and we got him signed to Capitol.
Oh.
And that's where the label that Music Is My Sanctuary is on,
okay.
Capitol.
Okay.
And that was with our partner from school, Larkin Arnold.
Now, the A-Team, how many people were involved in that?
Well, let me name them.
Okay.
Drums, Harvey Mason. Bass, Chuck Rainey. Guitars, David T. Walker, John Rowan, and Wawa Watts. Keyboards, Jerry Peters, Fonz, and myself. And percussion, Stephanie Spruill. And then we used King Harrison and Mayudu Correa. And that was the team in various forms. Sometimes we'd have 2 guitar players, sometimes 3. No, usually 2, but the 2 would change.
Okay.
Out of those 3 names.
Now, Stephanie Spruill, tell me about her.
Stephanie, we saw her playing at the Troubadour in L.A. With David T. Walker. He was part of the Motown session crew in L.A. And we went down to see David, and we saw this lady on stage playing percussion. And we were getting set to do Blackbird. Said to Fonz, boy, she's really going down. The thing about Stephanie was she's very creative. She didn't just play tambourine or just play bongos. She would have a variety of instruments up there, and she would be picking them up at random during the set. And each one of them, she'd add a unique flavor. You know, she wouldn't just keep a steady groove going on with one percussion instrument.
Right.
And she kept excellent time. He said, let's pair Stephanie. You typically, in those days, you'd use one percussion player.
Mm-hmm.
With the drummer. We said, let's pair Stephanie and have one guy playing just straight congas or bongos, just that, and pair Stephanie to add different rhythmic flavors.
Oh, okay.
In a separate isolation booth.
Okay.
And she'd just be in there with a whole plethora of different instruments.
Toys.
Toys. Yeah. She was back there in the toys in her own booth, and she would just throw down by herself.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
Always adding interesting flavors throughout the recordings.
Oh, my gosh. I just noticed that you were involved. Well, Fonz was involved in Skyrider.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's one of my favorite Jackson 5 recordings.
Oh, yeah. They did a lot of records that are still bleepers and that are a major part of the catalog. The Jackson 5 Christmas album.
Yes.
They did a lot of that. And a lot of those songs are played every Christmas.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Now, there are 2 things that I really want to touch on. I'd like to know the story of LTD, the elevation of LTD.
How we got together.
Yes.
We met LTD they are or were an R&B band, similar to Earth, Wind & Fire, with horns and vocalists and rhythm section. And we had been talking with A&M Records, with Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, about doing some things with them. I believe it, by that time we had signed a publishing deal with them prior to LTD or just after. And a friend at studio also, Mercedes Peake, was instrumental in telling me about LTD, and A&M was looking to do a record on them to really kick them off because they believed in the group, but the group was floundering as far as sales after one or two albums. And so we connected with A&M and had a meeting with the two brothers, Jeff Osborne and his brother Billy Osborne, about working together. And we played a couple of things for them. One of them was Love to the World.
I love that song. That is probably my favorite LTD song.
Oh, that's great. We love that song, too. Well, in fact, so much so that we did the slow version of it with
yes,
the kids.
Yes, the prayer.
The prayer.
Ah.
Love to the World prayer. And it was beautiful. We had some young kids in the studio, and they were laughing, and we just captured all of that. That was really great. And then we played, a friend of ours had written a song called Love Ballad.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they dug that. We got together and put together the album, used some of their tunes. And when we turned in the album, the label was very happy. And it launched the career of Jeff Osborne.
Now, he wasn't always the lead singer, right?
No, he was the drummer.
Oh, okay. How did that come about that he became the lead singer?
It was just one of those flukes that happened in the studio, that he was playing drums, and Bonson, I believe, had heard him singing in between takes, working on other songs. And it was a long project working with the group. Because, you know, they had a direction that they were used to going in, and they hadn't had any outside producers really to direct them, so that was something new for them to get used to. And the main lead singer at the time was Billy Osborne,
Jeffrey's brother.
We were going to cut Love Ballad, and I think Billy had reservations about doing it. I think he wanted to stay with the funky genre that they were known for, and we were going to go ahead and do it because we knew it was a good song. We felt it was a good song. And so we said, okay, well, Jeff, why don't you try the song? And that's the first time we really heard Jeff's voice, because he was a good drummer.
Uh-huh.
So Jeff came over to the mic and ran the song down once, and we said, man, this is the cat for this song. And then, you know, the rest was history from there. Yeah, I know Jeff, whenever he appears now, he's always singing that one.
Right. He has to. I don't think he can leave a place without singing that one.
He couldn't get off stage without it.
Right. And Taste of Honey.
Taste of Honey. That was a long project to get a deal on the group. We saw the potential in the group immediately, as image-wise, with a group that was composed of two ladies out front, which was fairly new at the time, playing guitar and bass.
Right.
And the fact that they could really play made it a no-brainer. And we took the concept around to several record companies, and they were performing when we first saw them right across the street from A&M Records at a club called the Etc. Club. It's no longer there now. So we hired a video crew and had them come in, video the group doing one of their sets, and we took it around to all of our contacts at the majors, and no one bit on it. And we kept pushing to get the group signed, and but finally we scheduled an audition up at the house for a partner from Howard, Larkin Arnold, who was over at Capitol, and he was just newly, he started in the legal department and then moved up to head of the one of the record labels and record division there. So he said, let's give it a shot, and we went ahead with it, and the record took off like crazy. Their album went platinum. Single with platinum.
Were they nominated for a Grammy, or they won one, or?
Yeah, they won the Grammy that year as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which was great all around. We were in the middle of signing another production deal, and when they won that Grammy, the price of the advance almost doubled.
Excellent.
But the timing was right too. Was timing in life? Timing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
The disco craze was big.
Right.
Now remember taking that rhythm machine I mentioned earlier, that Maestro Rhythm Ace that Sly used to use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it had a button on it for a snare drum, one for cymbal, and one for kick drum. Mm-hmm. And these were synthesized kick drum sounds. But you could push the button and you would get that sound of a kick drum. And it was a steady sound. So I took that box in and had the engineer run the tape down. And every time the drummer's kick played on the tape, I pushed that button throughout the whole record.
Oh, my goodness.
And doubled every kick drum lick all the way through the tune. Then we beefed that up and mixed it with his kick, and that's how we got a really strong dance kick.
Wow.
And in those days, it was today you can do it easily with drum replacement software.
Right.
But that was just one of the things we did behind the scenes.
Yeah, one of the other experiments.
Yeah.
One of the many, many experiments that worked.
Experiments continued.
Yes. For Hero. You recorded with For Hero.
Right. Deco, Mark Mack.
Yeah.
London, we went over to London.
How did that come about?
Surprisingly, it was unexpected, but we had been traveling, doing lectures for Red Bull Academy, different parts of the world, and we're just always very flattered that two generations away from when we recorded the music, the kids would come up with the original vinyl album.
Right.
And they asked us to sign them and knew all about the records and everything. Mm-hmm. And found out that we had garnered a following around the world. And that was true in London especially. So they were familiar with our music. And through a mutual contact, a lady by the name of Felice Lucero, she knew Digo and she knew me, connected me with Digo. And that's how we hooked up. A great bunch of guys.
Now, what's the name of the recording that you did?
Play with the Changes.
So, what you're doing, since you're not really retired, what's happening?
Well, we are cutting new things. We have some, you know, there was some things that Fonso were working on that were really good with new talent. We're going to, I'm going to finish up some things that he had just about completed and am working on some music over the years. We have, kept up with the technology. So we have, everything that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've been enjoying semi-retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And been doing a lot of interviewing,
right.
Shows, lectures for Red Bull, and at the same time working with projects like For Hero. And I expect to this coming year to be working on some, putting out some new things. About things that we talked about doing. One of the guys at the services for Fonso, trumpet player from Earth, Wind & Fire, we've been using on some of the new things we're working on. Of course, everybody was very emotional.
Right.
Then, and he was, he said one classic phrase there. He was saying to the whole audience there, he was saying, man, finish your projects.
Mm.
Finish your projects. And so that's kind of a very wise mantra.
Well, to finish up this project of our conversation. Thank you very much, Larry Mizell, for
you.
Joining Sugar in My Bowl. I really appreciate the time that you spent with us because we've been on this phone for a while.
We've been talking. We've been talking.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been fun and a pleasure, and I look forward to hearing the broadcast.
Okay.
Of you.
I hate to interrupt this song, and this is like the only chance I will ever play this song during this show, I guess, because Larry Mizell was our guest this evening. The half, one half of the Mizell brothers, Alfonso Fonz Mizell, having transitioned in June. Yeah, so it was really a blast talking to him. And there was so much, as you heard, referenced music that I couldn't even squeeze in. But right now we're listening to LTD, Love to the World, written by Larry Mizell. For the most part, many of the recordings we heard this evening were written by Larry Mizell, even though, you know, a few were written by Fonz Mizell. But for the most part, the bulk, as was Call on Me. We heard... Okay, let's start here. Before we heard LTD, we heard Change from Places and Spaces, which was written by Larry Mizell. Before that, we heard Call on Me, the Johnny... The Michael Jackson version. Yeah, we heard that version. From Farewell My Summer Love. And before that, we heard the Johnny Hammond version from Gambler's Life. What is that? Yeah. And before that, we heard Bobby Humphrey from Fancy Dancer, Una Esta, which was written by Larry Mizell. And as a matter of fact, Call on Me was also written by Larry Mizell. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. I should be back on the 18th with... with Terry Lynn Carrington and Nona Hendrix. Ms. Nona Hendrix, which will also be... Nona Hendrix will be with Carl Hancock Rucks at Harlem Stage. Where are they going to be? See, I told him to send me something because he gave me a website, and that would mean that I would have had to be prepared. And, There it is. Yeah, so on the 17th, don't act up now. You know, the players, they do what they want, only because I don't get to play this one. On the 17th of September, where is it? Come on, I don't have time for this. Oh, yeah. Nona Hendrix will be at Harlem Stage with Reno, Nelson George. It is hosted by Carl Hancock Rucks. Rare performances by these folkses. What is Harlem Stage's thing? Oh, you can go to the website, www.harlemstage.org. Harlemstage.org. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. I am so late. Sorry, guys.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.